Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm! Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comment. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. It is good to be with you once again. Today, I will want to take a little talk a little bit about a few things here, in particular, Mitt Romney's Bain Capital problem. I know Bain is pretty much becoming a pain in his side. Also, the dueling NAACP speeches, and I don't know if you heard this or not, but we're going to talk a little bit about the police officer in D.C., that made threats to the First Lady. Yeah, that's right, threats to the First Lady. And then in our sports segment, I want to know from you, which team, if they play today, do you think would win? Team USA 2012 or the Dream Team from back in the day? So all of these things we're going to be talking about today. But before we get started, I'd like to bring on the star of the show and my co-host, Jima Hill Cook. Now, Jima is the executive producer of Current Events with Patrick Cook, and the Chief Operating Officer of TaylorMade Training and Consulting. I introduce to some and present to others, Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start with the big brouhaha about Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. Now, in August 2011, Romney told federal authorities as part of the financial disclosure process that he retired from Bain Capital on February the 11th, 1999, to head the Salt Lake Organization Committee. Now, since February 11, 1999, Mitt Romney said he has not had any active role with Bain Capital entity and has not been involved in the operation of any Bain Capital entity in any way. Now, however, a corporate document filed with the state of Massachusetts in December of 02, a month after Mitt Romney was elected governor, lists him as one of the two managing members of Bain Capital. Now, I want you to listen to what Al Sharpton on Politics Nation had to say, and I want to get you to respond, Jim. Take a listen.
Documents given to a Massachusetts commission in 2002 show Romney still had full ownership in at least six Bain entities while he was in Utah managing the Olympics. And the commission found Romney was still serving on the boards of companies that had Bain ownership stakes in Staples, Marriott, and Lifelike. All this paperwork show Romney still owned Bain 3 years after he says he retired from the company. Now, his opponent in 2002's governor's race, Shannon O'Brien, hammered him on exactly this point.
The fact is you were still signing documents as CEO of the company while you were away. And as a matter of fact, in the summer of 2001, when you were leaving the Olympics, you actually made a statement in the paper that in the summer of 2001, you were finally relinquishing 100% control of your position within Bain.
Romney's answer then was the same as his answer now. Deny everything.
Now, of course, I know Reverend Al was being a little facetious there about denying everything, but essentially, that is what he's doing. I mean, time and time again, Mitt Romney comes out with one position and then ultimately opposes the position later on. Here, there are SEC signed documents by him that actually contradicts everything he said for a span of almost 3 years. So, Jima, I pose the question to you. Is Bain becoming a pain in Mitt Romney's side?
Well, I can't say it's becoming a pain, because if you even go back to the primaries when Newt Gingrich and company first brought up information about Bain, you know, they were quickly silenced by the higher-ups in the party, but it was enough that somebody caught wind of it on the Democratic side and decided to keep investigating. So it's been a pain for him for quite some time now. But it's been one of those nagging pains. You know how you stub your toe and you're like, ouch, that hurt, and then the pain kind of go away and you don't really mm-hmm. feel it again until you, like, go put on a different pair of shoes. Mm-hmm, and then you mm-hmm. kind of remember, dang, did I hit my toe? What's wrong with my toe?
Right, right.
That's what's going on with him right now. What's wrong with Bain? You know, it's like all of a sudden his association, although it really hasn't been all of a sudden, but the way he's responding or not, you would think that no one's been talking about Bain for the last, you know, 3 to 4 months. We can even go back to, you know, the infamous statement that Mayor Cory Booker made that, you know, saying, oh,
right.
he's going to be talking about it. And with
right.
Ed Rendell, former governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell has said. I mean, so there's been even some Democrats that didn't even want this to come out because of their own relationship. Because, and it's not that it's an issue. No one really cares. What makes us care is that he's not telling us something. That's
what makes
us care.
Okay, so that's fine. Caring is one thing, but why is it relevant, though? I mean, why are we even having this conversation about Bain Capital at all?
Because Mitt Romney said he's best to be the best president because of his business experience. That's
okay.
why Mitt Romney put Bain Capital into the political process. The president didn't. The Democrats didn't. Not even his other former primary contenders didn't. He brought that up. So he got to dance now with the one that brought him.
So basically, he was kind of arguing that President Obama had this community organizer experience and he had this business experience, and he touted Bain Capital as an example, right? And so he said, yeah, I was at Bain and I did all these wonderful things at Bain. And so now people are really finding out when they peel back this onion that it stinks and it wasn't all that good. And he had some issues, particularly with outsourcing and firing people. So does this issue challenge his credibility at all?
Yes, it challenges his credibility, because even if you go back to the primaries, when he first started talking about the amount of jobs, he said it was 100,000 jobs he had created. And then a week or so later, he had to dial that number back to 10,000 of jobs he created. And then a week or so later, he had to dial it back again, and he had to say 1,000 or so jobs. And so he's already, you know, credibility was already began to waver as it related to what Bain Capital was all about. Okay, so you come forward, you know, 3 or 4 months, and here we sit. We sit here once again because he made the comment of his business experience and yet has made no mention of his governorship when he was governor of Massachusetts. So obviously he felt more comfortable. He felt like his business experience better qualified him than the elected position that he had actually, you know, won when he was governor of Massachusetts. So if you're going to run on your business experience, then you have to run on your business experience. That's all of it. That's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And once again, I sit on the side of the fence where I really could care less about Bain Capital, because whatever it did, it did, and those people lost their jobs. He, you know, whatever happened with the companies where they outsourced and the jobs went overseas, you know, that happens in business. You know, you invest, shareholders have a certain expectation. I get all of that. But at the end of the day, the problem here is the secrecy. The problem here is the inconsistencies. And I have no faith in a presidential candidate that can't come clean about his own record. So if you can't come clean about your own record, then how can I trust you to go and sit before men of other nations and try to defend the United States? I can't do that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. And that's why I posed the question in the beginning. Can Mitt Romney be trusted, right? You know, I really would like for people to weigh in. And to weigh in on the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And we also have a chat room out there open as well. So Jim, you mentioned three things: secrecy, inconsistency, and you also mentioned coming clean, right? So when I look at this, and a lot of people like me wouldn't understand what it means to be a CEO of a company and then go overseas and run another company and get paid $100,000 for your interaction or non-interaction with that company and while you're managing. So it can get convoluted and it's all technical, right? But I can or will understand if someone says to me, here's my resume, or give me your resume, and I put these things down on my resume, and I haven't done. So it's almost like to me that he's lying on his resume, which I think most people can understand.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, you say you were not somewhere, but you were, or you wasn't there. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know what the lie is now. It's so confusing. So I'm interviewing you for a job, and I go to call this company that you claimed you worked at and that you had this stellar job performance at, and they have no record of you. Or I call a company and you say you was just there for a little while, and they tell me you was there for 4 or 5 years and in this capacity. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So it's kind of like, would I hire that person if that person came to me for a job and I checked his references? Would I hire him? Having sat in the position of hiring people and checking references, I can tell you I would not hire him, because he lied. He misled on his resume, and because of that, then I can't trust him. I can't have you working for me.
And see, this is what I think is the relevant point. You just put it, you articulated really well. The fact that when we hear the pundits and the news people talk about the technicalities of him being a CEO and him going through and working for one company and not, when you make it plain, just like we just did, about here I'm going to present you with my credentials. You go check my references. When you check my references, do they pan out? If they don't pan out, then you're misrepresenting yourself. And if you're misrepresenting yourself, I cannot hire you because you're not credible. So if you're not credible on this, you cannot be credible on anything. And so therefore, I can't hire you. So we as American people are in a position where we're getting the chance to pick the next employee, i.e. the president of the United States. And so Mitt Romney, to me, cannot be trusted because of those things. And we haven't even talked about his taxes. Why is it that he won't release his taxes? His dad released multiple years. What's in those taxes, do you believe or think, that he's trying to hide?
you know what? I'm not sure. And it, and once again, it may not be anything. His taxes and how he, you know, did his deductions may very well all be legit. It very well may be. But because you're not showing us what presidential candidates have shown for 30 years or more, it doesn't make sense. Why does he feel as though he's exempt from doing what every other presidential candidate has done before? And the fact that he gave more than enough 4 years ago to John McCain when he was being vetted to be vice president. So here we sit, John McCain saw your taxes and decided to go with Sarah Palin. Do the math.
Right, exactly.
Obviously,
right.
You know, and so I'm waiting for that leak to come on out because somebody somewhere knows. And he knows that somebody else somewhere knows. And it's just a matter of time, and it's probably just a matter of the dollar figure being the right amount for that person to come forward and have some sort of exclusive story about what they saw. So it's best that he go ahead on and put it out himself because we're nearing the middle of July. You really don't want to go into August and people still trying to figure out what was on your taxes, you know, a couple of years back. And it's not that it really matters. It's not even that it matters. But the fact that you're not wanting to show us tells us that you're not, something there might not be right. But because you haven't shown us, you leave us all this time to speculate, and now people are investigating and finding, you know, accounts off in the Cayman Islands, over in Bermuda, and all of these things. And why do people put money in other banks that are not in the country? Well, they're hiding it. I mean, you know, we know that. We've seen enough television shows to know why people place money in overseas accounts.
That's right.
So, you know, we get that, and we're like, okay, that's fine, but you can't run for president, and we don't know, A, where your money is, or B, how you got your money.
Right. As my mama would say, something in the milk ain't clean.
That's a very true statement. Yeah. Something about this just don't pass the smell test.
You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. Let's move on now to the dueling speeches that Mitt Romney and Joe Biden did over the past week. And I want to talk a little bit about Mitt Romney, but first, I want to play a little clip from the Lawrence O'Donnell show and some of the things that Mitt Romney said during the NAACP peace speech. Take a listen.
I do not have a hidden agenda. And I submit to you this. If you want a president who will make things better in the African-American community, you are looking at him. You take a look. If our goal is jobs, we have to stop spending over $1 trillion more than we take in every year. And so to do that, I'm going to eliminate every non-essential, expensive program I can find. That includes Obamacare. And I'm going to work to reform and save.
Okay, so obviously he was a hit, and of course I'm being facetious, but the fact of the matter is, it seemed to me he's kind of arrogant to say what he did and the way that he did it. And there were some other things he said about, I like the way your organ music sound, just a bunch of things he said like that. So do you think Mitt Romney has a problem communicating with working class people? And I'm going to say working class because obviously there's he's just in a different class of people altogether.
The short answer to that is yes. And I say that because he's never been working class. A lot of people, most people that you know have ascended to a certain level. So they've gone through the ranks to get to a certain point. And so because of that, they have some sort of, you look at Joe Biden, who they have some commonality with the common man. Mitt Romney doesn't have that. That's why it's very difficult for him to relate to everyday people because he has nothing in common. He never has. And so he's one that when you hear him, it's almost like he's not even from here. I mean, literally, like from Earth. I don't know. Like he's from somewhere else sometimes.
Exactly.
Or that he's been so scripted by whoever his handlers are.
The Manchurian candidate.
Right, for sure, the Manchurian candidate. He almost doesn't sound human. He sounds like a robot. And so because of that, and even if you just watch his mannerisms, if he said nothing and you just look how he responds to certain questions, you're like, dude, we're supposed to ask you these. You're on the national stage running for the highest office in the land, the most coveted office in the world. You know, everybody wants to know who the president of the United States is and wants to be on that president's good side, and you don't think we're going to ask you certain types of questions. Well, that's shame on you, Mitt Romney. And so for him to stand before the NAACP as he did, that's how he always comes off. I've never felt a warm and fuzzy from Mitt Romney when he's talking about anything. Probably the closest I've gotten, and it's probably because it was in a tweet, is the other day when one of the Obama campaign's staff members suddenly passed away. He sent out a tweet offering his condolences. And that was probably the most warm I've ever felt from Mitt Romney. Mm. But once again, I say because he didn't say it. It was something that was written. But it wasn't something that he verbally, you know what I mean? So,
Right.
I don't think if he had verbally said it, if I would have felt the same way.
So what I guess the question that I want to add then, how can Mitt Romney or anyone that carries themselves like that or has that type of demeanor be an effective leader if he doesn't understand the plight of all people? Now, you know, I understand if you talk about the ascension that most people have when they come out of poverty to wealth or some experience in that. But if you have no experience in that, how can you relate to the majority of the people that you're leading if you haven't gone through anything like that?
Well, I think it's a couple of ways. I mean, I'm not sure George W. Ascended, but George W. did not come off like Mitt Romney. No shape, form, or fashion. There were certain periods where you actually liked George W., where you actually felt, you know, like, you know, there might be a heart in there. He might be breathing, you know. I've never felt that from Mitt Romney. Never. And so it's really the person and who they surround themselves with. And it might be that George W.'s ascension came through his bout with alcoholism. Maybe that made him be common.
Some kind of vice. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mitt Romney, and I'm not saying that one has to have a vice or one has to, you know,
right,
come through the ranks or whatever. But if you're wanting to relate with people, you really need to know how to understand people and to listen to people. And even if you can't do anything for them at the moment, give them a listening ear. I don't think Mitt knows how to do that. I'm really beginning to wonder if his wife does. Everybody keeps wanting to place her as some great surrogate, and she knows. No, she doesn't. I don't think she has a clue either. When I hear her talk, I hear the same condescension I hear out of Mitt Romney.
So I guess what perplexed me a little bit is that, you know, he has his opportunity. You know, he could potentially be the next president of the United States. And so if you don't have an understanding of the majority of the people that you lead, then the policies that you put in place won't have any impact, a positive impact on the people, on the majority of the people. They will influence the dollars that are flowing through his campaign is another indication of that, too. Because, as you know, if people are funding his campaign, they're going to want kickbacks. I mean, this is obvious. I'm not going to drop $1 million or $2 million or $10 million in a campaign. And if you win, I'm going to get something out of it. At least I'm sure that's what they think. So the policies that he's looking at pretty much instituting down the road cannot have a positive impact because of his experiences. What do you think about that?
Well, he's already told us that. He's going to get rid of the Affordable Health Care Act. That's going to affect 30 million people. He's going to deregulate all the financial institutions and all the places that need regulations. He's going to get rid of those. He's going to increase taxes on lower and middle class people and decrease taxes for the higher end income people. So just those three things alone lets you know what he's going to do and who's funding him, who's buying for him, who's paying, for him to continue to run and continue to be the front runner. And so he hasn't kept that a secret what he plans on doing, but yet he keeps talking about my way is better, except you haven't told us what your way is, and all you have said, much as the Republicans on Capitol Hill, is what you're going to get rid of, but you haven't told me what you're going to replace it with. And the one thing you said you would replace it with, the Ryan budget plan, is a travesty for minorities, for women, for children. It's a travesty for older Americans. There's no way we could survive under that. So it's no secret what he plans on doing. The secret is, how did he get to be the presumptive nominee? That's the secret. How did that happen?
Well, I mean,
I watched it, and I don't know how it happened.
Exactly.
I mean, live in color at all the debates, I was like watching.
Okay.
But it was such a weak field, and he came out looking like he was smarter than everybody
line,
in
right?
the room.
Yeah, exactly right. So let's shift now to the president for a minute. Now, president took a lot of heat this week because he was not at the NAACP convention himself in Houston. So there's some talk to say that he's taking the African-American voter for granted because he didn't show up. What do you say to that?
I say people need to go find something else to do.
What do you mean by that? I mean, he didn't show up, right?
Okay. Okay, let me refresh everybody's memory, because he was there last year.
Right.
And when he went, it was, he's trying to shore up his base. He went to National Action Network last year. And when he went, he's trying to shore up his base. He's just doing this because it's close to election time. I don't know if anybody remember all that talk. He is going to National Urban League's conference next week in New Orleans. So for every year that he has been in office, he has gone to a national organization's conference, whether it was NAACP, whether it was National Action Network, and this year National Urban League. So he's done more, let's just be real clear about this, than any other sitting president as it relates to not just going to one organization. He's gone to all of them. And each one of those three, the National Urban League, the NAACP, and National Action Network, they all have very different agendas in terms of things that they focus on. You have the NAACP that looks at a lot of things around the justice, DOJ, and voting rights issues and things along that nature. You have National Urban League that's concerned about jobs, and their focus, I'm sure, this year's conference is going to be about job creation, working for the youth. You have National Action Network, whose initial focus a year or so ago was around education, and now it, too, is looking at civil rights issues and violations and things of that nature. So each organization is doing what it's supposed to do, and the president has gone to all of them. So instead of picking, and a point came out today on the Melissa Harris Perry show, this was the same week that another organization was having their conference. I want to say it was La Raza. And so instead of picking one over the other, he made what I thought a very good decision, just to go neither one of them. Because had he went to the NAACP and didn't go to that one, then your Latinos would be upset. If he had went to La Raza and didn't go to the NAACP, then black folk going to be upset. So you know what? I'm just not going to go with neither one of y'all. Now y'all figure that out.
You're right about that. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. We're going to talk more politics on the other side.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages. Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, I want to shift to a very disturbing topic. Now, this one has to do with real threats to the First Lady. That's right, First Lady Michelle Obama, by a D.C. police officer. Now, I want to play something by the Associated Press. And Jim, I want you to get you to respond to this. What is going on here? Take a listen.
A Washington, D.C. police officer has been moved to administrative duty for allegedly threatening First Lady Michelle Obama, according to a report by the Washington Post, first published Thursday. The officer was overheard making comments that he would shoot the First Lady and then used his phone to retrieve a photo of the gun he would use, the paper said. Residents of Washington, D.C. were outraged when they heard the news.
When you sign on for a job to protect and serve, that's your job. If I was the president or the president's wife and I had somebody who potentially could be threatening, I wouldn't want anything to do with them and I wouldn't want them around me.
Common sense, why would you threaten the First Lady?
If it turns out to be true, then I'd say that officer should be dealt with very harshly.
D.C. police say they are investigating the matter, while the Secret Service says it will take appropriate follow-up steps. Matt Small, The Associated Press.
Jima, what does it say about our society?
That we are in a world of trouble when it has become almost more commonplace for people to think it's okay and that it's no big deal to make jokes about harming the first family of the United States of America. It's really sad because no one's shocked anymore because people have been doing it since the day he announced his candidacy, since the day he won the nomination from the Democratic Party, and since the day he was elected and the day of his inauguration, there has been jokes, emails, snide remarks, threats, shooting at the White House, talking about throwing him out of a helicopter. I mean, it's just been all sorts of things. And yet we're supposed to sit back and act as though this has absolutely nothing to do with race and that this has just people just feel that way because they don't like her telling them what to eat. This has absolutely nothing with them telling people what to eat, because I don't recall hearing this when Nancy Reagan was out there telling people don't do drugs.
Right.
Nobody wanted to throw her off a helicopter.
Right.
So you can't make it be about anything but race. And it's sad that we thought, and this is what's really sad. This is the saddest part for me. And I didn't fall into this category because I live in a real world and I live in reality and I face some form of racism every day or some form of discrimination every day, either based on my race, based on my gender, based on my age, based on my weight. I face it every single day. So the sad part is so many people really thought that we were a nation that really had gotten over itself and so had really gotten over this race thing. And it's those people that I feel the sorriest for, because they really don't know what to do. They don't really understand how this is happening. But I get it, because we've never gotten over it. It was just hidden because there was no need to show it, because no one of significance was in power. But now that the head man of the free world is a person of color, oh, this is completely unacceptable to those people.
So I guess what's appalling to me more than anything is the fact that most of the people that we're here that's conducting themselves in this fashion are people in authority, people of authority. And so here we're talking about a police officer. We're talking about disrespect by people in the House of Representatives. We're talking about people pointing their fingers at him as heads of state. And so, I mean, I can expect this from the people in Timbuktu or the people in the backwoods country, areas making these type of statements. But people of authority, Jima, when did we get here?
We've always been here. I bet if you were to ask people that work for these people that are people of color how they feel when they're in the room with that person, and they'll tell it to you. But we've never had to ask, because these people were not relevant. She wouldn't have done that to George W. Bush. She wouldn't have even done it to Bill Clinton. So the fact that she did it to this president, it lets you know why she did it or why she thought it was okay to do it. For the man that stood up, Joe Wilson, that stood up and made that statement during the State of the Union, he would have never done that to George W., nor would any Democrat have ever done that to George W., or to Bill Clinton. And both of them did lie.
Right.
Both of them lied. And not one time were they interrupted in the State of the Union address and was called a liar. And you mean to tell me that this is not because he's black? I don't care if he's half black, all it takes is a drop. I don't really care. That is the only reason that has happened, because it has never happened to any other sitting president. And until you can show to me that it has happened to another sitting president in my lifetime, then I will stick with what I know, that this is all about race, and that I guarantee you that those people, you look at the police officer, now this is a police officer, so now you have to wonder, does he carry such deep-seated hatred toward all people of color? Who's he arresting when he's out there on the beat,
Who
is he harassing? Who is he stopping? Who is he giving tickets to? Now everything about him has to come into play.
Absolutely.
It should. If they want to do a true investigation, they need to do that. And the sad part about it is that there are more good cops than bad. But it's the bad ones that we hear about, and it's the bad ones that we should be scared of. I'm scared of Joe Wilson. Because if he was my congressperson and he was representing me, he couldn't be representing me. Because he
wouldn't
know anything about what's in my best interest.
Right. So there are many cases around the country where the police, we just talked about, are getting a bad rap. But incidents like this with the First Lady and developments in New York around stop and frisk raise some concerns. Are these concerns warranted, Jima? I mean, should we be concerned now that we see these incidents time and time and time again by these police officers, men in authority? Should we be concerned?
Yes, and we should have always been concerned. The problem is that we are concerned for a moment, and then we lapse into some sort of coma, and then something happens and we're concerned for a moment. And the moment needs to last longer than a moment. It needs to be a movement. Reverend Al and Reverend Jackson have been talking about police brutality 20 or more years now. This isn't anything that's new. It's been going on. If you look back at what California is the prime example. It's been going on out in the Oakland area of California for years. You know, for years we've been talking. There's been some case out of that city every year around some sort of police brutality. But for some reason, we err on the side of, oh, whatever the suspect or the victim was doing that made it okay for the police to do what they did. I don't care if he had just robbed a bank and threw his gun down on the ground. You didn't have to shoot him because he was no longer a threat.
Right.
It's those cases where the victim is no longer a threat that I have a problem with. I don't have a problem with you protecting yourself as a police officer. I have a problem when you're no longer in danger and you still got to protect yourself. Who are you protecting yourself from? The next person? Because that person's not doing anything to you anymore.
Right.
So it's been an issue, and we haven't been vocal enough to make it stay an issue. Our outcry hasn't been loud enough to make it stay an issue, or you wouldn't hear about it so frequently from so many different pockets around the country.
Yeah. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. We're going to go to the phone lines right now. We're going to take a call from last four, 2345. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You have a question or a comment?
We want a suite, then we have to follow suit. They bought that 5 years.
Caller on 2345, your mic is hot.
I wonder what Patty is now.
Hey, caller 2345, your mic is hot.
225, your mic is hot.
2345, your mic is hot.
2345.
Yeah, that's you. That's you.
Yeah, that's you. You.
All right, I'm gonna put you back on mute. Okay, so I want to shift now to the Stop and Frisk campaign. You know, we talked a little bit about it just a moment with respect to the police department, right? And so for those of you that haven't heard, the New York the Police Department's Stop and Frisk practices raised serious concerns over racial profiling, illegal stops, and privacy rights. The department's own report on its Stop and Frisk activity confirmed what many people in communities of color across the city have long known. And Jimmy, you just mentioned this. The police are stopping hundreds of thousands of law-abiding citizens, New Yorkers, every year, and the vast majority are Black and Latino. Now, in response to comments made this morning by Mayor Bloomberg at the Greater Allen AME Cathedral of New York, the New York City Liberties Union issued the following statement. It is attributable to New York Executive Director Donna Lieberman. It is a lot easier to trash the NYCLU than to acknowledge the widespread dissatisfaction the community feels with an NYPD that acts like it's above the law and accountable to no one. Today, more than 1,800 New Yorkers will be stopped and frisked by NYPD officers. Tomorrow, more than 1,800 New Yorkers will be stopped and frisked by NYPD officers. The day after that, more than 1,800 New Yorkers will be stopped and frisked by NYPD officers. Every day this year, more than 1,800 New Yorkers will be stopped and frisked by NYPD officers. Now, this is not about an argument between the mayor and the NYCLU. This is about the humiliation, frustration, and disrespect felt by New Yorkers from communities of color every day as they are subject to the mayor's stop and frisk regime. Jima, where's the breakdown?
Well, the breakdown is, as Reverend Al said the other day on his show, it's obviously that they're stopping and frisking the wrong people since there's been an increase in homicides and shootings in the
right.
area. So obviously, whatever they're doing, they're missing the people that they need to be stopping and frisking. So I'm kind of in the middle of the road on this in terms of if it's done fair and equitable across the board, I would be okay with it. But if you're only going to concentrate it to a certain area of the city, then you're lending yourself for people to think that you are calling that particular area out, making that particular area feel like it has to be on a certain notice and not other parts. If you're truly concerned about curtailing crime in your city, then this is step one, but it's not the end all to be all, because you really got to take a look at, you know, where are your crimes happening, who are the victims and who are the perpetrators, what else is going on in that neighborhood, in that community, in that area that you could also go and stop and frisk, i.e., how many liquor stores are available, how many gun shops are around, how many places are abandoned are around, what are you doing, mayor of the city, to address flight out of the city, what are you doing to address these abandoned buildings, are you going to tear them down, are you going to refurbish them, what are you going to do to make the city viable again? See, all of that plays into it. So the stop and frisk for me is just one step. It's not the end all to be all. But unfortunately, that's where they stop. They stop, they frisk, and then they send you on your way because they ain't found nothing.
It seems like to me that this tactic will make the community hostile. And then, moreover, once they're hostile, it kind of creates a buildup of animosity between law enforcement and the people. And if you have this animosity in a neighborhood like that, the people are going to be in a no-win situation because the law is on the policeman's side. So, therefore, it goes back to something we talked about a few months ago about this prison industrial complex, right? The fact that now these prisons are being taken over by these commercial entities, and therefore they're creating these quotas by keeping the population at a certain percentage. So do you think these things are kind of going hand in hand here, or what's happening with the larger community?
Well, that's why I'm on the fence on this, because in my opinion, and this is the world according to Jima here, in my opinion, the community's level of hostility is disingenuous because they know who's carrying the weapons in the community. They know where the dirt is being done, and they're not doing anything about it, or they're not, you know, making the call at the time they need to make the call to stop something from happening. So, you know, because somebody else is benefiting from whatever Pookie is doing, then they're not going to go tell about what's going on the corner. Although you sitting on your stoop and you know exactly what's happening, but nobody's talking about it. Let's go back to the show that used to be on HBO, The Wire.
Right, right.
One of my favorite shows. And The Corner. I don't know what, I think The Corner was on there too. Well, both of those. Everybody on those blocks knew what was happening. You can go home right now, and in 5 minutes, you know where the dirt is happening in your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. I know where the dirt goes down in my neighborhood back in the
exactly.
hood. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so who's calling? Who in the neighborhood is strong enough, firm enough, care enough to make the call to say, this is finna go down, and we need some backup over here? Who's going to do that? So for me, the hostility of the community, I find it to be a tad bit disingenuous, because they could do more to stop it on the front end. And then after something happens and then Pookie end up getting shot by the police, we want to be mad at the police for shooting Pookie, although Pookie responsible for 20 people being shot that year.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, make it as plain as I possibly can.
Right, it makes sense.
And that's where, you know, we as a community have to do a better job of holding ourselves accountable and holding our family members accountable and the people in our community. I tell you all the time, there's not a whole lot that goes on my mama's street that she don't know about. And when she finds something that is out of order, she's making a call to whoever she thinks can handle it. And she's going to continue to call until she gets some results. That might be calling Channel 9 News. But she's calling somebody. And you're not just going to be doing whatever you want to do on her street. You're not going to do that. And my mama's 70, about to be 71 years old. Who's coming behind her that's going to have that same conviction?
So it seems like to me then the community has a choice, right? The choice is to police themselves or allow these policemen to come in and kind of interact with this type of behavior. Now, I think the policemen can come in with a better approach, i.e. they can probably come in and try to establish relationships, maybe have workshops, start being in the community in a positive manner and not just coming around when things are always bad, right? If you come to a neighborhood every time there's a shooting, then, of course, you're not gonna be seen favorable. But if you're in the neighborhood helping picking up trash or volunteering in the community, that kind of helps build the relationships. So I hear you and I agree with you, but I think it should be a joint effort, not just one or the other.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I do. I agree with that. I think when anybody comes in too, you should work on building up as opposed to taking over. And therein is where the difference is that a lot of times government, city, local, whatever, makes these decisions based on what they think the data is showing, and instead of going in and soliciting input from the people that's in the community, they go in and tell the people what they're going to do. If I'm on the receiving end of that, I'm already hostile because you didn't even ask me. You didn't even
right.
ask my opinion about what the real problem is, because what your data shows you is one subset. I could probably tell you what's really happening. Because I'm on the ground. I'm in the projects. I'm on the stoop. You know what I'm saying? And so that's where some of the hostility comes in as well, is that people come in wanting to take over as opposed to trying to work with. So I agree. It should be a joint effort to have, you know, a task force, which I really hate that word, but anyway, a collaboration of both the police departments, the city, you know, civic groups in the community, churches in the communities, to come together and say, okay, here's what we see. How can we address this issue? What times of day should we do most of our patrolling of the neighborhood? You know, when do you notice there to be more idleness in the community? When are people most congregated? Where are they? What, you know, and get some real numbers and times and specifics about what's going on, and then come up with a plan on how you're going to address what the concerns are of the community. Because, and here's a prime example. Under Bill Clinton, you know, he had some moments of good things doing that in his juvenile crime bill that he passed back in the 90s. And one of the things that got a lot of flack was when they talked about midnight basketball. And when they talked about all the money he was pouring into these type of organizations that provided recreation activities. And what that took children off the street because they were somewhere else. They were doing something else for a period of time. And so you begin to see a decrease in juvenile criminal activity. And so what happened almost instantaneously is when the money ran out that was funded toward those programs, then you begin to see an increase again in juvenile crime. And I don't think anybody has made the connection that when the money left, so did the kids having somewhere to go, which means now they have nowhere to go, which means now they're out there holding people up and robbing and raping and killing people. No one has made that connection because they haven't funded the programs back again. Now, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, which goes to the larger issue is of why crime is taking place in these areas, because there are no jobs. There are no jobs and there are no tax dollars being spent in these neighborhoods. I often talk about the fact that where I grew up, there were not any sidewalks. We walked through trails and we walked on the road. And sidewalks is a big thing for me because I want to be able to walk in my neighborhood or jog in my neighborhood if I want to. But where I grew up, there were no sidewalks. So because there are no tax dollars being spent in my neighborhood and because there are no jobs on a large scale that will provide the tax dollars. So I think the larger picture is an economic issue, and which goes us back full circle to a political issue, right? If we elect the right people to get us the right jobs in there, then I think it'll kind of help this crime. You say what?
But I agree with that, but I still go back to some of that responsibility being and accountability being on the community. Because if I'm a business owner and I'm coming through your neighborhood needs to show me that it is a viable place for me to do business, right? And I can't see that if I can't even see businesses because ain't nobody cutting the grass on the house. Or you got 4 and 5 cars sitting on top of concrete in your front yard. Or, you know, the place that was a business that had to close up is boarded up and got all sort of gang graffiti all over the building. And, I mean, so, you know, why would I want to come here? So the people in the community have to do a better job of taking care of the community if they want people to come in. We complain about it. I mean, I complain about it all the time. I go home, and I'm like, we don't even have a grocery store that I would want to go grocery shopping in that's close. That's close to the house. You know, you got to travel a little bit of ways to get to a good grocery store. And it shouldn't be that way because it didn't used to be that way.
I know that's right.
And then the corner store used to be okay. You could used to could go in the corner store
get
and
everything
pick up
you need.
A few items to get, you know, to tide you over till you made it to the grocery store. But the corner store don't have nothing in there now, if it's even there. And so, you know, so we have to own what we've allowed to happen in our community. Yeah, I know the people are going to say, we're not bringing drugs here across the border. We're not flying them in. But we're selling them and we're smoking them. So now what? You are still responsible for what you're allowing to happen in your community, in your neighborhood, and in some cases, even in your house. That has nothing to do with the president. That has nothing to do with the police. That has everything to do with you and what your moral and values are. And until we take a hard look at that, because you have a pocket of people, just like you have a pocket of people that I don't care what the president does, it's not going to be right. You have a pocket of people in certain communities that just think they can do whatever they want to because they can, because they feel like somebody owes them something. And at the end of the day, nobody owe you anything. What you owe yourself something. You owe your children something. That's scripture. You're supposed to leave something for your children and your grandchildren, and you can't do that if you're smoking up everything you're getting. So there has to be some accountability and responsibility on the community side in order for a business to even want to come in. Even if you go look at what Magic Johnson did, and he's done everything,
right,
bless his little heart. He's gone into some of the worst neighborhoods, but he forced those communities to clean up
first
before he came in there.
Right, right, right.
And he forced those other businesses to step their game up. You're not going to be an anchor store where my movie theater is selling all this nonsense.
So everybody
can do that. Everybody can do that.
When are we going to do something about it? So when are we going, as a people, going to do something about it?
We're not. We'll be having the same conversation next month, next year. However long we're on the air, because as I stated, there's a certain pocket. They are perfectly content with how they live. And you know that. You know that firsthand. Some people are perfectly content not knowing anything. Some people are perfectly content not having nothing. Some people are perfectly content with subpar. I just happen not to be one of those people. You know, you're not going to not give me the best because I know I deserve the best. So you're not going to give me a book that's 10 years old and expect me to learn from it. No, I want the same book that your child is getting. Whether I'm in a public school or a private school or a charter school or whatever type of school it is. I don't care what kind of school it is. I want the same book because I deserve the same book.
That's right.
And I'm going to force you to give me the same book, whatever that means. And so if I believe that, then I'm gonna push you to do that. See, the civil rights generation believed it. They believed that they were worthy of more than what they were getting.
And they took action.
Right. And when you have Mary McLeod Bethune, whose birthday was this week, by the way, who decided, I'm not just going to do a school, I'm going to do a whole college.
Right.
Because I understand the value of education.
Right.
Who decided on her own, you know what I'm saying? Who whatever she got, she went home and taught everybody else in the house who wasn't going to school. That particular era of people, I'm not sure where they are. And we say some of us are still out here, and all these platforms, we have so many platforms, media platforms right now. Everybody I know got a show somewhere, either online, they live streaming, they on Blog Talk Radio, they on Sirius, you know, XM somewhere doing something. They somewhere. And so if all these people have all this positive energy, where is the results of all the positive energy? Where is it?
Yeah.
Instead of tearing down the national organizations that have been in place, NAACP, for 100 years, why are you not a part of it? And then go
doing
into
your
local
own
chapter,
mm-hmm,
and say, let's find out what part of the city needs us most. We don't need another banquet honoring nobody.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And everybody get all excited about who the keynote speaker is. No, what we need to do is find out where the part of the city that needs us most. What, you know, what's going to be our vision this year as a church? What are we going to do outside of the walls of the church that's going to have a positive impact on somebody's life? What's the vision there? Are we having church in the building?
Right.
But what
you're
are
not
we doing
outside
of
the walls
of the building?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you got a point. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. This is the top of the hour. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Steamer, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my equal.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. There are reports now of heavy fighting in Damascus, and the International Red Cross has declared Syria in a state of civil war. UN observers investigating the most recent bloodshed in Tremsa have been told that Syrian troops went door to door in search of their victims, targeting army defectors and activists. At the Center for Strategic and International Studies, analyst Aram Nagizian says that Syria appears destined for years of unrest.
This country will be at war with itself and at war with its economics, its socioeconomic distribution, and the ill effects of poor governance for the next decade.
In terms of the UN observers said pools of blood and brain matter were observed in a number of homes. President Obama says that Washington feels, quote, as broken as it did 4 years ago. Appearing on CBS Sunday Morning, the president expressed this regret.
I haven't been able to change the atmosphere here in Washington to reflect the decency and common sense of ordinary people, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, who I think just want to see their leadership solve problems.
Later on CBS Face the Nation, officials for the Obama reelection effort and Republican Mitt Romney's campaign dueled over the time frame of Romney's tenure as chief of Bain Capital, a firm associated with extensive job outsourcing. Dry weather conditions are prompting the Department of Agriculture to declare natural disaster areas in more than 1,000 counties across the country. Alabama Public Radio's Maggie Martin has more.
Federal officials are declaring more than 30 Alabama counties as natural disaster areas. That means farmers in those areas are eligible for low-interest loans to help them weather Alabama's drought. John McMillan is commissioner of the state's agriculture department. He says corn crops are suffering the worst.
That's going to translate most likely into high food prices because all of our livestock, including beef and poultry, depend on corn as one of the major sources of feed.
More than 90% of Alabama is abnormally dry or in a full-blown drought. For NPR News, I'm Maggie Martin in Tuscaloosa.
The price of a gallon of self-serve regular in the U.S. is $3.41, according to the Lundberg Survey of Fuel Prices. Analyst Trilby Lundberg says prices have dropped about 7 cents over the past 3 weeks, but prices per barrel are rising.
Right now they're up more than $7 a barrel in 3 weeks, and our gasoline demand is climbing.
Lundberg's survey found the lowest average price at $3 in Jackson, Mississippi. The African Union Commission has its first female head. She is doctor and diplomat Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, the ex-wife of South African President Jacob Zuma. This is NPR News. Academy Award-winning actress Celeste Holm has died. A relative tells the AP the 95-year-old actress was hospitalized about 2 weeks ago, suffering dehydration. She reportedly asked to return to her Central Park West apartment Friday and died early this morning. NPR's Jeff London has more.
She made her mark at the age of 25 playing the coquettish Ado Annie, the girl who can't say no, in Rodgers and Hammerstein's 1943 musical hit Oklahoma. Other stage and screen roles followed. Celeste Holmes specialized in wisecracking featured roles in films like All About Eve and Gentleman's Agreement, which won her an Oscar. Throughout her long career, Holmes adhered to a philosophy of keeping things light, she told NPR's Terry Gross.
You know, we're the only industry outside of musicians whose work is referred to as playing. And it has to be playing. We have to really play together. And that's what the audience responds to.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
A rough turn for recently signed New York Knicks point guard Jason Kidd. Police in Southampton, New York say Kidd was treated for minor injuries after he crashed an SUV into a telephone pole early today. He was released without bail after being arraigned on a drunken driving charge. At the box office this weekend, Ice Age Continental Drift was the big winner, earning $46 million. The 20th Century Fox animated film is the fourth in the decades-long Ice Age series and the first in 3D. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News. Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're joined once again by the Chief Operating Officer of TaylorMade Training and Consulting and the Executive Producer of Current Events with Patrick Cook, Jima Hill Cook. Jima, now I want you to kind of continue the conversation that we were having. I want to continue the conversation we were having before the break. And it was primarily concerning stop and frisk. But we were talking about stop and frisk being sort of the byproduct of a larger issue in a lot of communities. And you were pretty much kind of stating the fact that the issues of taking care of our own, cleaning up our own neighborhood, and then allowing the economic engines to come in and to provide jobs that would, in fact, help taxes or at least generate tax dollars so they can do things for the community. So I wanted to make sure that you were able to complete your thought on that before we move on to the next topic.
Yeah, I think I have pretty much said all I wanted to say. I just don't want us to forget, you know, or lose sight of the fact that we still have power in our voices and what we can do in our community to save ourselves. We don't have to always look outside of the community. And when we show ourselves to be friendly and to be open to receive what's coming, then more things will come. But we must begin to look at this thing for what it really is and own up to some of the issues that we have allowed to happen because we didn't say anything about it the first time somebody did it. So that, you know, after one person did it, and the next thing you know, 20 people doing it. And now it's so out of control, you can't, you know, just go knock on somebody's door now because you don't know, you'll be knocking on doors all day. And so we've just got to do a better job of when we see things beginning to get out of order, as I stated, when my mom sees the grass across the street at the vacant lot not being cut, she doesn't wait till it's up to the pole. She calls the first time she notices it, and she continues to call until the city comes and cuts the grass. And so, because her grass is cut, so she feels as though the grass across the street needs to be cut. And so, you know, that's what we need to do. When we see something immediately, then we need to say something about it or make some sort of impact where we feel as though we're being part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Outstanding. So we're going to go to the phone lines. I see a caller and a few callers in the queue here. We're going to go to caller last 43732. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now give us your name and where you're calling from. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yes, this is Mr. Motivator.
Hey, Mr. Motivator. How are you?
I'm doing great. I just wanted to make a comment want to let you know that I've just really been enjoying the show today, and I think you guys are covering some areas that a lot of people have questions about, and so I'm just happy to hear somebody finally talk and offer some ideas and offer some ways to tackle a lot of the negligence and things that happens to that we experience around us.
Well, we definitely appreciate that, Mr. Motivator, and we're glad to have you join us today. And for the listening audience out there, Mr. Motivator has a show that airs every Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time, and it's a great show. It talks about a lot of great things motivational-wise, and he also has a book out there that he talks about called Success is an Attitude by Dwight Drefford. So, Mr. Motivator, it's always a pleasure to have you join us, and we're just glad you called in.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So, Jima, I want to kind of shift now to another controversial topic that has been plaguing the news for the past few weeks and months, and this is about Joe Paterno, right, and the Penn State scandal, if you will. And so Eugene Robinson wrote an interesting article, and I want to kind of read it. And it was, and Eugene has a way with words. Of course, he's a decorated writer, right? Mm-hmm. And so I want you to take a listen to this, and I wanted to get you to respond. He says, outside the Penn State football stadium stands a statue of legendary coach Joe Paterno, his arm raised in victory. Right next to it, university officials should erect another figure in bronze, a young boy crying out in anguish and being coldly ignored. What do you think about those comments?
Well, is Eugene being true to form, that's for sure.
Exactly.
And, I mean, I think when this story first broke, we talked about more people knowing than what they were letting on. I think we even alluded to that Paterno probably knew some things that he wasn't saying. And so I wish I could say I was shocked by this new report that came out, but I'm not, because there's no way all of those kids that did finally come forth and it happened and no one knew about it. I just wasn't believing that, especially when the assistant coach said he went to Paterno and told him.
Right.
And he was like, I don't want to upset nobody's weekend. Are you serious? That was what your answer was? And so, you know, and we don't want to speak ill of the dead. However, comma, you know, that he has some he's going to have to be held accountable some kind of way. I don't know how you do it and somebody's gone on. I don't know if they take back his severance they gave him, where he negotiated a $5.5 million deal right when all of this was breaking. And so, you know, it wasn't – he's fine. His wife is fine. The family's fine. Everybody, you know, Paternos are going to be okay. But I would think that the school would need to offer some sort of financial assistance to those young men that had been violated. I doubt if it happened, but, you know.
There's a lot of talk about them providing millions of dollars for a victim. But in his article, he goes on to say that Penn State's Board of Trustees commissioned former FBI Director Louis Freeh to investigate how child molester Jerry Sandusky, for years one of Paterno's most trusted and loyal assistants, could have committed his awful crimes under the noses of university officials. The answer is simple and shocking. Those officials simply look the other way. The most saddening finding by the Special Investigative Council is the total and consistent disregard by the most senior leaders at Penn State for the safety and welfare of Sandusky's child victim, the report says. Four of the most powerful people at the Pennsylvania State University failed to protect against child sexual predator harming children for over a decade. Jimmy, that's powerful, and mm-hmm. it's devastating. And for it to reach such high in the officials is asked a larger question. You know, when it comes to child molestation and you have to make a decision between protecting children or protecting the institution, I've seen with this particular case and with the church, people want to protect the institution.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. And it's unfortunate for the victims because, you know, where do you go if you can't go to the people in charge to help you, to save you, to protect you?
Yeah.
Because that's what they say they're there for. I mean, you know, so unfortunately, you know, that's the nature of the beast, that the institution, the name, the brand carries more validity than for that young boy who was, you know, may have been orphaned or, you know, raised in a single-parent home or may have had, you know, some sort of disadvantage. His life isn't as valuable as the life of the institution. And that's sad. That's really sad.
And what's more shocking is that the opportunity there was kind of, nip this thing in the bud and then get rid of that employee right then and there, make it public, and then show the majority of the people how hard you are on this particular situation. But instead, the evidence seems to suggest that they allowed this to continue to happen, because it didn't happen one time, nor
right.
two times, nor three times, but multiple times. And I'm sure over that time span, you had a different officials come and go, because people don't stay in those positions unless you're a coach for many, many years. So you have different staff coming in and out. So multiple people knew about it. But it seems to me that they was protected.
And this went on for 20 years almost. I mean, this isn't like, I mean, this went on, they were talking about this back in the 90s. It's 2012. So, I mean, it's just sad on so many levels. And the saddest part is that I wish it was an isolated event, you know. I wish it was just at Penn State. But I would venture to say that it's not just at Penn State, that things such as this nature, as you already alluded to when you're speaking about the church, it happens all the time. And we can just make it even smaller. It happens all the time in families. Families want to protect the institution as well. You know, for the daughter whose mother's boyfriend is molesting her, and the mother doesn't believe the daughter because of who the family is, and the daughter has to live with that guilt and shame for the rest of her life because no one believed her, nobody protected her. I mean, it happens even at home.
Yeah.
And so if it's happening at home and we want to protect whoever the perpetrator is, then it just goes up the ladder, you know. And then it's happening at church with the priests and the pastors and the wives and what they know and don't say. And then it's at schools where you have, you know, girls being assaulted and nobody's saying nothing because it's the football program or
right.
it's the basketball program or it's the baseball. And then this team is well known, and then the coach is the coach of all coaches. And so but it starts at home.
Yeah.
The very idea of protecting the institution starts at home.
Yeah, we're going to go to the phone lines right now. We're going to take your calls to join the conversation. The number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Caller, last 4761. Your mic is hot. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Gomer Sundar, and I'm calling from Philadelphia.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Good, yourself?
Absolutely wonderful. You have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I have a comment. I was listening to the young lady speak. I agree with what she's saying. Also, I'd like to add that I think that Joe was more of a fall guy than anything else.
Oh, you know, fall guy, you said?
Yeah, Joe.
Okay.
I think that he followed the right procedure. I think he followed protocol. Given the circumstances, he's at a position at a school.
Mm-hmm.
He saw something wrong, and he reported it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what else is expected from him? I mean, if he comes out to the media and everything, definitely he's going to lose his job. So he followed protocol. Hopefully that from there it's taken up to the right levels, and then action is taken. And I'm pretty sure there have been others who have done the same thing. I can't see a school operating so long with these things happening without someone saying something about it. So my only suspicion as a former police officer and an investigator would be suspicion lies on the top level here. You know, there has to be some people there involved who wanted a fall guy and who are covering things up. There may be a couple other people who are doing this. You know, I mean, who is this guy Santucci that he can do whatever he wants and get away from it? You know, and get away from it for so long, unless someone was protected. I mean, the only one that could protect him were the leaders. You know, of the school. So that's the way I feel. But you know, it has to be more involvement here. And they try to close it up real quick because I don't think they want the eyes on them. You know, on the president and everyone else. I mean, somebody resigned due to this, and I'm pretty sure the FBI is going to pay them to visit, you know, and find out what's going on. But, I mean, there have been schools that practice this kind of stuff. And we know how these, you know, I hate to say it this way, but only white men do. And, you know, they tend to like this kind of stuff and protect each other, you know. They fit the profile.
Mm-hmm.
of pedophiles and so forth. You understand? Males, white male, according to certain age, that you know that go after kids. So there may be some type of group there that hires these kids for something. I mean, there is something else involved. And I'm pretty sure high officials in the school have something to do with it. So I hope that the FBI really dig in deep into this, and I'm sure they're going to find something other than making Joe the fall guy. Because if Joe was not that, I mean, he's a good man, he's a strong man, he's 85 years old. You know, emotion, enthusiasm, or I mean, he didn't want to hear this. Look, he died right after this.
Right, right.
You know, this stressed him out.
Right.
This stressed him out.
I
think that what he wanted was put this out there, and hopefully, these people follow their protocols and take it. But you know, people are criticizing him now and take everything down from Joe and that. And wait. Not that he gave so much to the school. That besides that, but the fact that he followed protocol and he probably was scared to go beyond protocol. But if somebody were to talk to him after the school, after that retired, and say, hey, listen, what do you think about this? I'm pretty sure he would have said, this guy is a pedophile, the school was this, and I'm pretty sure he would have let it all out, what's really happening in that school. So that's the way I feel. But, you know, unfortunately, he passed away. And, you know, even that death should be investigated. God knows, you know. because in this kind of world that we live in, you got the Illuminatis, you got groups, pedophile groups, that are very powerful, that are judges, that are politicians. These guys all fit the profile.
Wow.
All fit the profile of Illuminatis and pedophiles. So, who knows that somebody was sitting there to inject something in his hospital bed? Who knows? You understand? I mean, it's happened before. You know, so, I mean, all things should be investigated with this because it's happened too quick. A four guy was this guy. It's like something changed a little bit and said, well, we're going to have to prosecute you. I'm sorry. Because he was so confident he was going to get out of this. I'm sorry. Because in the last times that he was going to court, he seemed a little sadder than he was in the beginning. So, you know, they probably told him, man, you know, I'm sorry, man. You know, we can't let nobody else to fall for this but you. You know
what's interesting is that, you know, Joe is such a mammoth figure at Penn State, right? I mean, he's, like, huge. And so why not somebody smaller or some other person, no-name individual? Because the reality is if Joe is the fall guy, as you suggested, that means the program, the football program, the legacy of all the things that Penn State stood for also falls with Joe.
Well, I think to save their butts, they don't care. And I think by giving them a big fish, we think that we shut everybody else up. If they give a small guy, it would be too obvious, hey, you threw a little fish to us. No, there's got to be some bigger fish.
Okay.
And I think that's the case there. And I think it should be investigated, you know.
Interesting. Now, one other question. You talked about protocol. Now, when you say he followed protocol, now when you look at something like pedophilia, right? You're talking about somebody molesting a child, making a call to your official without reporting it to the police, without reporting it to some larger figure. Doesn't that seem to suggest he's kind of condoning the situation if he doesn't follow up with the call?
I would say so. I would probably be calling the police. But then again, we don't know what surroundings, what condition, and what pressures he had there. And he probably was, the protocol was could have been strong, say, hey, you must call us first, and we will call the police. He might have believed that they would call the police and an investigation would take place. That way his name would not be involved and so forth. So he probably might not have felt that if he doesn't call the police, they will call the police and let them handle this nasty, dirty thing. And my name will not be on it, as Joe Paterno was the one that called the police. Because the police didn't record everything.
Wow.
And they know where the phone number comes from. So it might have been that reason. And it can be a couple other reasons. But I would probably call the police, you know. But then again, I don't know the circumstances of that particular school and how fearful they are of their protocols or what procedures they have in place. But I know there is protocols, and you have to follow them.
Yeah.
And I will probably grab the phone and say, hey, did you hear what this guy did? You know, and you probably reported it. And then the other person in the other line probably calmed down. Don't worry about it. That's bad. We're going to take care of this. We're going to get an investigation. Would you cooperate? Sure, I would. So now he's relaxed. It's no need for him to call the police.
Right.
He feels he followed protocol. He feels these people are going to do everything to protect the kids in the school, which is the problem here, the kids. You know, the hell of a dirty old white man. But these kids, kids is the ones that are traumatized. These kids are the ones that were affected with this, you know, and that's the shame on it. But I'm sure it happens, not just in the school. You know, there's a lot of that stuff around. You know, I investigated similar stuff at schools and certain places. I mean, you'd be surprised the corpse and the things that these people have, you know, in place. And the power. And the power that they have.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you for allowing me to call in.
All right. So, Jamie, what do you think about those comments? The fact that, you know, he mentioned Joe probably followed protocol, and he's a big fish. You know, I was kind of suggesting that, well, maybe not the Penn State program, but he got a point. You know, if I give you the big kahuna, you know, maybe you'll end up just thinking the butt. What do you think about that?
Well, I have two faces on that. The first one I have is that I would buy the following of protocol if this was an isolated event, if this was one victim. But we have too many victims for Joe not to have known all along what was happening. And if every time he only followed protocol, and i.e. he called the higher-ups and said something, well, we all know, and we can play the semantics, that Joe really ran Penn State, not the president of the school, that he ran that area, that the police responded to him. You know, they would ask him what to do. At least that's the word on the street anyway. And so, you know, Let's be clear about that, first of all. So if it was an isolated event and, you know, one victim recently, but this thing goes back too far for it to just be he followed protocol. You know, my profession requires me to be a mandated reporter, and so I don't have the luxury of waiting on somebody else to tell me to call the police or to tell me to call Child Protective Services. I have to do that anyway. Even if I do tell my superior, I still have to call Protective Services or the police, regardless of what they tell me, because I'm a mandated reporter on such things. And so because of that, you know, that, and maybe putting it on Joe, he can't defend himself because he's gone. So, you know, we don't get to question him. We don't get to ask him when he first find out. All we have is what his testimony is saying. We know people lie under oath all the time. So, you know, we don't get to go back and do that. And so therein is, you know, maybe let's just say Joe knew more, and now, you know, we're calling into question the integrity of the program. What would an NCAA do? Probably nothing. How does the school recover? You know, putting together a task force and redesigning the showers is a symptom. That's a symptom. They're looking at symptoms. They're not really looking at how do you address the culture of and Penn State is just one of all the thousands of schools we have in the country. You know, how do you address the culture where it's okay to do things that are illegal and immoral and unethical and then say it's all okay? You know, how do you
right.
change that? And it's the same thing when you're talking about police departments that do certain things and everybody hides behind the shield and everybody protects the blue or whatever it's called, you know, the blue shield. And so knowing that officer has done something that is completely egregious, but no one will step up because, you know, they're protecting the shield. It's the same culture. How do you change that culture? How do you change that culture in a community that sits by and allows drug deals to go on and gun deals to go on and drive-by shootings to happen, and you don't go and tell the person that can possibly do something about it? How do you change the culture? So throughout our society, we have these issues of needing to change the culture, but who's going to be the change agent? Who's going to be the one that's really going to address the issues and address the hardcore problems that are going on and not just the symptoms? Not just what we see on the surface, but what is actually driving that behavior? What is it in your psyche where you thought it was okay to allow that to happen for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? You know, that's what we have to get to.
Okay, so now probably over the next days, weeks, years to come, you know, more and more of the truth will come out. And we'll eventually get to the very bottom of it, right? We'll know if Joe followed protocol. We'll know if he was, ultimately the fall guy. But in the meantime, I haven't heard any remedies to try to fix the problem going forward. And then secondly, I hear a lot of talk about the death penalty to Penn State. You think that's going to happen?
No, because I don't think the NCAA is going to do that. I'm not sure if I think they should. I haven't really flushed that all the way out yet. I mean, on the one hand, those things that happened were horrible, but then you I don't know what all the rules are. I mean, we know you can't get money from a booster, you know, is what happened with SMU. They got the death penalty. We know you can't have somebody else taking your test because that's a violation of the rules. And, I mean, you know, we know what those rules are, you know, in terms of what gets you suspended or what makes you lose a scholarship. But how does this fit when, on one hand, it had absolutely nothing to do with the football program, but on the other hand, it had everything to do with the football program because this guy, Mr. Sandusky, was still allowed to come on the campus. And so I'm thinking, this is just the world according to Jima, that at the moment they knew something was going wrong and they still allowed him access to the campus, those years should be forfeited, whatever they got during that time. They should have to give it back. But from that time up until it all, you know, broke is how long they should be prohibited from participating in a bowl game or anything like that. That's just my opinion, though, because if you let him go, you knew something was happening, so why didn't you take it to the next step? And for I fought Joe Paterno all the way up.
So how is it then that SMU could get the death penalty for some arbitrary NAACP rules? NCAA rules that are associated with, you know, with passing money around, and Penn State is actually doing criminal activity and not considered the death penalty for it. How can people reconcile the two? I mean, both players were involved. I mean, players were a coach, the administration was involved in both cases.
Because they're going to say that it was not a direct. Some of the victims were not players, so it was an auxiliary of Penn State. It wasn't really Penn State, although it happened on Penn State ground. Some of the stuff you're talking about, what happened in the shower. You're talking about coaches seeing things that happen. You know, I would be suing everybody. I wouldn't wait on nobody to tell me who to sue. I'm suing everybody. If that was my child, I'm suing everybody. I'm suing the state of Pennsylvania for something.
Yeah, and I think they are doing it. I would also like to see them talk about how they're going to, you know, move forward in the future and prevent this type of.
That's what I'm saying. What they're talking about doing is changing the layout of the showers, and that's what I'm saying. The things they're talking about doing are symptom things.
Exactly.
They're
right.
Not talking about addressing the culture. And it's not just Penn State, but that's what we're talking about today. They're not talking about addressing the culture of a system that allows this to happen for this amount of time, and appropriate decisions was not made to get law enforcement involved sooner rather than later. See,
right.
So whoever I'll give you an A for effort when you're talking about this, and you don't need a task force on this. This is another situation. You don't need any more data.
Exactly.
You have everything you need to put a plan in motion. You've got to decide what's the first step. Okay, so you say your first step is you're going to change the layout of the showers and something else in the locker room. Okay, I'm going to give you that. If somebody thinks that's important. But now what are you going to do? What kind of diversity training classes are you going to have for your coaching staff? What kind of mandated reporting are you going to put in contracts?
And better screening.
And not just on the football, but across the board, Everybody that's associated with the university will now become a mandated reporter. So for the janitor who walked in and saw something, you are just as accountable and responsible as the coach, because now anybody that works for us or has any type of business on campus is a mandated reporter. So you need to report.
Right. And, you know, got somebody.
That's how you address the culture.
Got somebody in the chat room, Goomer Zendo, saying they're putting a Band-Aid on a heart attack. So,
that's right. That's
absolutely right. Absolutely right.
That's,
you know,
true. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
They need open heart surgery, and you tell me I got heartburn.
Right, exactly right.
You telling me to take some Zantac. Right.
So I want to kind of shift now to, for the last segment, staying in the sports theme, but I want to kind of shift to a lighter topic, right? The Kobe Bryant made this statement, right? This bold statement about the Team USA 2012 version could beat the Dream Team. Was he crazy when he made that statement?
He was out of his mind.
So what do you think? Do you think that the Team USA 2012 version could beat the Dream Team? And if you do,
no.
Or not, why not? Why not?
No. When you look at that Dream Team, it was that. They were prime in the prime of their careers. They played for the love of the game. They played with heart. They knew their role. They knew their positions. Each one of those players redefined their positions. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about how many times you hear of the next Michael Jordan, the next Charles Barkley, the next Patrick Ewing. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't hear that about these people.
Right.
So, you know, they are, when you look at the Dream Team, those guys redefine how you play basketball. And how we're playing it today is based on how those guys played the game.
Yeah.
There's no comparison between the two. I'm just, you know, I don't know what happened to Kobe, but, you know, there's no way. And Michael Jordan's in their prime, with this team in their prime, be able to hold them. It's not possible. Not possible.
So the BleacherReport.com has this article out, and it says this. Ever since Kobe Bryant boasted his 2012 Olympic team could beat the original 1992 Dream Team, comparisons between the two squads have sprouted up all over the place. The media reaction to Kobe's remark is one of disbelief, just like I did. The Dream Team is supposed to be the greatest team ever assembled, so how could anyone possibly defeat the juggernaut? I actually don't think Kobe's statement is as far-fetched as everyone makes it out to be. It's often forgot where Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, supposedly two of the best on the original team, were at in their respective careers. Magic had taken a whole year off before 1992 Olympics, after acquiring the HIV virus, forced him into retirement. By the time the summer games came around, Magic wasn't in the same kind of game shape he was usually in, and his play wasn't at the Hall of Fame level for which everyone remembers him. Although he hadn't officially retired yet, Bird had just finished his final season in the NBA after battling lingering back issues that forced him to miss 142 games over his last 4 years. Those four seasons featured Bird's worst shooting percentages of his career. Nevertheless, if the two squads could somehow face off in a best-of-seven series, I would take the Dream Team in five, if not a clean sweep. And so in this article, he talks about the Dream Team being not in their prime like these guys or near their prime. He'll talk about them really being at the end of their career and about all the things, the ailments that they had prior to leaving the game. But if Kobe seemed to suggest them in their prime against the Dream Team in their prime, at least that's how I interpret it, that they would beat the Dream Team hands down. Now, I believe Kobe was in shock after them losing in the playoffs, and he has not yet recovered, but nevertheless, I think it was a crazy statement.
Well, you look at this year's USA team, and if my memory serves me correct, you have a couple of them on there that are injury prone. Even my OU alum, you know, Blake Griffin, they concerned right now because he hurt. So, you know, the fact that he brings up Magic was at the end. But you're talking about Magic and Bird, who still, at the end of their career, put fear in people.
Without question, yes.
Even at the end of their career, they put fear in people. Nobody wanted to play Larry Bird. Nobody wanted to play Magic.
They hated
to play him.
Exactly.
So, I mean, and when you look at that group and you say, there's not one that you actually hate to play. Who do you hate to play out of that group?
Yeah.
I mean, you say, I let Kobe beat me because ain't nobody else going to score, right?
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, that's what you hear. So there's nobody on the team today that you're like, man, who I don't want to play against them. There's not one. I'm sorry. I mean, even though LeBron is who LeBron is, LeBron just, you know, I don't hear nobody saying, I don't want to play LeBron. They did not want to play Bird. They did not want to play Magic, MJ. Barkley was going
to
knock you over. Karl Malone was going to run over you.
Yep.
And Ewing was going to make you feel like you was 2 feet tall. So what?
So I like the analysis of the heart that they play with. It seems like to me that team or that genre of players, that era of players, had a lot more tenacity. They had a lot more heart, a lot more gut, a lot more grit than these players today. It seems like these guys. I mean, remember when Michael Jordan played with the. When he had pneumonia, a broken leg, and I think he had spinal meningitis or something like that, and a broken ankle when he went for like 85 or something like that. So, I mean, that is the kind of heart they played with back then. I don't see these guys playing with that kind of heart today. And so even if they were matched up talent-wise, I believe that fifth dimension, which is heart, in my opinion, would take the dream team over the edge.
For sure. And that goes back to when we talk about the struggle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were in that part where the NBA was turning, and they were part of that turning. And so they remember what the players was getting paid, because some of them came in like that. But they were able to turn the tide. So you got this new generation of folk who don't know what it's like not to.
Yeah.
Based on what that group did to get them to where they are. And so they don't understand. Those guys played for the love of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And they put everything out there on the court. And I'm just not convinced that this group will put everything out there on the court. I remember I think it was a championship, when Isaiah came out with the thing wrapped around his leg. And played with that hamstring injury. I mean,
right.
You remember that? I mean, that was classic.
That was
classic. You know, my toe hurt and I ain't playing today. I you know, it's unreal. So I think you're right. I think that fifth dimension, you know, the heart part would definitely take the dream team, the original dream team, over. The old dude said in five. I'm gonna say it's a clean sweep. I don't see these guys having enough. To play together enough,
right?
You know, because you know some of their animosities towards each other is personal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't get all that back in the day. I didn't know who really didn't like each other. I knew who didn't like each other's style of play.
Right.
But when you talk about how these dudes be putting each other out on Twitter and stuff, you're like, dude, y'all finna be on the same team. How y'all gonna work together?
Yeah. So it looks like Gomez Indian in the chat room also agrees with you. He said they have more love for the game, not the money. And and I think that separates, again, that separates that era from this era, right? Because it is a business now. And so you talk about the loyalty that they had back then. It's kind of difficult for the players now to have that type of loyalty, because these managers or these owners are getting rid of you in a heartbeat.
For sure.
And so the players are now picking up on that. And so they don't have that, you know, I want to start my career and end my career here, because they know within 2 years it could be all over. You know, and free agency.
And I don't have a problem with that, but I need you to play. I need you to show up every game. I need you to be working on every part of your game that you can possibly work on and try to get better. That's what I need you to do. And whether you got three more guys around you that can assist you or not, you do what you're supposed to do. But let's not forget, you know, Michael Jordan didn't win a championship his first year in the league.
I know that's right.
Mike, he was vested, you know, about 5-6 years in.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took time to get everybody else around him to play to the caliber in which he was playing. He wasn't going to win a championship by himself.
Nah.
That wasn't going to happen.
But, and he brought everybody up to his level, too. He brought
that's
everybody
right,
up to his level.
But you can ask LeBron that. LeBron,
right.
You didn't win by yourself. Kobe,
right.
You didn't win by yourself.
Right. And they all, and they all know, they should be able to appreciate that nowadays.
Right. They should.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So we only have a few more minutes left, and I want to talk about this kind of this story breaking right now about Jason Kidd. Basketball star Jason Kidd was arrested for driving drunk on Long Island early today when he crashed his luxury SUV into a telephone pole after partying at a club. Kidd, who just signed a 3-year, $9.5 million deal to be point guard for the Knicks last week now, he crashed a 2010 Cadillac Escalade on Cobb Road near his home and near Watermill just before 2 a.m. this morning. So what's going on with these players? And you know, if you're making that kind of money, why are you driving yourself? And why are you that drunk driving yourself?
And let's do one better. Let's do one better. Because I think Jason Kidd is about as old as we are. So let's
right.
Do one better. What exactly are you doing out drinking at that time at your age anyway? Because
exactly.
It was already going to take you 3-4 days to recover just because how old you are.
Right.
So now you got injured or scraped up a little bit. It's really going to take you a longer time to recover. So what was he thinking? Just I don't know. I don't understand. You're right. You're making that kind of money. Why are you driving yourself, number one?
Right.
Why are you driving yourself drunk? And who let you get behind the wheel of the car and drive yourself? I mean, you have all those questions. I mean, who in your circle will tell you no? Who in your circle will take the keys from you? If you don't have nobody in your world that's willing to do that, then they are really doing you a great disservice. They are setting you up for failure. And we hear about it way too many times. Who tells you to go fight somebody? Chris Brown and Drake or whoever that was fighting. I mean, what's up with that?
And it's
two grown men making that kind of money. What exactly do you have to be angry about the fight?
Yeah. That's crazy.
Like two broke people fighting? I can understand because y'all both mad y'all broke.
Right.
But what is it that y'all got to be fighting about? I don't understand.
And to take the story a little bit further, the New York Daily News saying that TMZ has a photograph, a picture of Kidd, which is 39 years old, bent over being held up by another person as he left the nightclub at 1 a.m. So
right.
The people around him knew he was that drunk, too drunk to
definitely.
Be getting in the car.
I just said that. So, the lucky thing for him is that he was the only person that was injured. Because if he had injured somebody else, then they should have been able to sue the club people that let him get behind the wheel of a car and anybody that was with him and him too.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking, if I'm holding you up, right, it's one thing for me to be sitting around, we talking and we drinking or whatever, and then I get up and leave. But I'm holding you up. I know you can't hold yourself up.
And
you
the valet driver that gave him his keys, I'd be suing them
all
too.
All of that should be. Now, of course, he still has some personal responsibility. We talked about that for a whole hour, I think, early in the show.
Right, but that's why I'm suing everybody. I'm going to sue everybody.
He should also get it too.
Yep, the all valet right. driver that handed you your keys, and he probably gave him a 100 spot, a bill, you know.
Yeah.
Man, I'm good. And he, you know, paid him a few, gave him a few change. And he gave him his keys, and here we sit.
Yep.
Now, the tragedy of it would have been if he had been killed in this drunken.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's the tragedy.
Yeah.
And then all those people that were there that allowed it to happen, you know, how would they feel about that?
Right. All right, so that's we're closing up on the show today. What are your final thoughts for today?
Well, I have a couple final thoughts today. One is please, please, please go out and get registered to vote. Vote is important. I don't care who you vote for. I just do not want you to not exercise your right to vote. Find out what the rules are in your state and make it happen. If you know somebody who needs some assistance, try give them $5 on the ID or something. Take them to where they need to go to get the ID. do what you can, because it's not just that. Some people need to have their original birth certificates, and they have to send off for that. And that's not cheap. They run from $35 to $55. I know, because I had to do one not too long ago for my son. So go out and find out how you can help somebody who doesn't have the right identification so they can be able to vote. It's so, so, so important. And also, read for yourself. I believe Patrick put out the link for the Affordable Health Care Act. Read it for yourself so you'll know what's in there. There's all sorts of distortions out there about who's going to have to pay and who's not. And we'll probably spend a little bit of time next week talking about that on the show, because people are so confused. I've had so many conversations with people about what was said or what's in the law. And so we need to talk about that. And we need to clear up some things as it relates to the president and what he said around marriage equality and what's been attributed to him that he did not say. So we're going to spend some, hopefully we'll spend some time on those two issues next week in the coming weeks. And on a personal note, for those out there who may be attending this week's conference in New Orleans for the National Association for Blacks in Criminal Justice, I will be doing a training session entitled Managing the Ship Between Relationship and Leadership. And these are tools for women that are in management positions, primarily those that the conference is geared towards participants that work in the criminal justice system. But my tools that I have developed are for women and some for men, regardless of what career industry that you're in. But that's this week in New Orleans, National Association for Blacks in Criminal Justice. And my title is Managing the Ship Between Relationship and Leadership. And I think it's going to be a pretty good session and really identify those areas of what happens when our ship is wrecked, when we're in management and leadership. You know, how do we turn our ship around and get things back on track? So I'm excited about it. I haven't done a training in a while, but I'm excited and looking forward to it. So just keep your eyes and ears open and stay positive for the week. And if you're somewhere hot, stay cool.
Okay, so we got Gummer Zendo in the room is asking for the website. What we're going to do is we're going to put it on the blog. So go to tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com, and I'm putting it out there in the chat room right now so you can get a chance to go see it. We will put up most of the information within the coming couple of hours. Give me a moment to put it together, so if people are interested, I can go ahead and put most of the information about where she's going to be speaking, the title of her presentation. It's a powerful presentation. She was the director of a facility for many years, a plethora of credentials. So, Jimmy, we're going to be looking forward to you having a successful venture down there in New Orleans next week. All right.
Are you going to put out there the link, too, for the Affordable Health Care Act?
Yeah, I will also put that out there as well. I will put out the link. And, in fact, we'll put out the link. We'll talk about it. I'll post it on Facebook, Current Events with Patrick Cook, our Facebook page. And we'll give people a chance to respond and talk about it all week long. And then on next Sunday when we have our conversation, we'll talk about it and take the questions from Facebook and from Twitter, and we'll talk about them during, when we talk about the Affordable Care Act next week. All right. Well, thanks to everyone in the chat room. We also thank you, Governors Endo. We see you out there. And also our guests and everybody who called in today, especially our caller from Pennsylvania. It has been a pleasure.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent, Jima Hill Cook. Now don't forget to follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time.
5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to current events with Patrick Cook. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMade Talk Radio, all one word, .blogspot.com. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Take us away, Joyce.
Yes. Yes. Yes.